Hey, folks, Tyler from Being This Person here. This week I talked to Alan, and he was a little hard to nail down, but partially because he's so busy, because he has so many interests. And once I did get him here, he was really excited and fun, and he really let loose, and partially because he is so enthusiastic. And he's science-minded, and he connects with people, and he explains things in great ways, and you're going to love him. Just like you love all of them. And thank you for that. At this point, I would encourage you to subscribe and leave good ratings and reviews on whatever podcast feed you get us through. iTunes does kind of rule the world. But really, the good ratings help other people see that some people like it and they'll try it. And then we can all connect a little bit more. It'll be great. I would also ask you to tell a friend, and not just about this podcast, but about podcasts in general. Maybe help them figure it out on the phone or their tablet or what have you, whatever technological device. But I think it's an important medium where we all get to share and connect a little bit. I do have an email. It is beingthisperson@gmail.com. That is all lowercase letters. There are no spaces, and it is spelled correctly. I also, being this person on Facebook, is pretty easy to find. And there is a website, beingthisperson.com. Again, all lowercase, no spaces. I do have a personal Twitter. It is @DonesTyler, so DonesTyler. I don't do a whole lot, but I do a little bit. And it generally relates to this show and a couple of other things that I have going on. But now, thank you, folks. I appreciate you. I appreciate you for listening and enjoying these people. Let's roll the theme music. So, first question is, who are you?
Who am I? I am a father, husband, son, brother, scientist, and adventurer.
Scientist is great because we were doing rock testing right before we turned on the mic. Which is
a little mineral identification, yes.
And, father, all right, so I get the father, son, you said brother?
Yeah.
Those connotations, but you said science, adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, adventurer.
Well, of all the things I am, that's the one that I have sought out myself the most. so I consider life to be an opportunity for adventure, and I try to seize it at every opportunity.
You certainly do. I mean, you were talking about You're having your buddies over to climb rocks at your house this evening, but it's really climbing rocks in your barn. But I've been in there. It's a stunning place. And so rock climbing, clearly. Mm-hmm. You just recently rode your bicycle across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You've been known to show up at a festival or two in your life. Are those the kind of adventures?
Exactly, yeah. Things that break the mold, outside the norm, where the outcome is uncertain.
How do you come up with the ideas?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one.
Where's the inspirations?
Pretty gut level, most of them, or external. Pretty gut level. I've known I wanted to climb since I was a kid. My uncle took me hiking when I was 12, and that was it. I wanted to climb rocks for the rest of my life. So pretty visceral there, not much thought involved. All the bike riding stuff, that's my wife's thing. I'm just along to create a slipstream.
You bicycle commute like 20 miles. Come on.
Yeah, well, I'm really not interested in driving. We live a little, outside of town, and we're not interested in burning fossil fuels on the way to work and back every day, so we usually ride. So,
and you both seem to enjoy it.
Oh, I love it. It's an addiction. Oh, yeah. It's an endorphin addiction. I mean, There are all kinds of ways to get one's brain addicted to endorphins, and certainly endurance exercise is among them.
It is scientifically proven. I mean, you get to a point of tired, apparently, and then your endorphins really kick in. Do you feel that?
Oh, yeah, it's savory. Huh. Yeah, it's savory. Nothing like being bleached by effort.
Yeah. That bleached by effort is pretty good.
Yeah, that's how I see it, is bleached by effort. I feel like someone has just put me through the hot wash cycle with plenty of bleach, and I came out all white and shiny.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Is there anything else in the world that gives you that kind of a sensation?
Well, I mean, no, I don't really do a lot of other drugs that would lead to that kind of endorphin response in the brain. I don't drink. I seek adventure.
Yep, parenting. I mean, I've had some pretty crazy endorphin releases for parenting.
Yeah. Yeah, parenting's a different sort of adventure.
Kids share a knee surgeon. I mean,
right.
You've seen your kid go down.
Yeah, he just retired, by the way.
I know.
Yeah, kind of a bummer. I'm wondering who's going to be the next one to sew me up. So,
yeah, right.
He sewed me up a few times, too. So, anyway, sorry to lose him. But, you know, parenting is something that I'm not particularly well qualified for. My wife has a bunch of younger siblings, and so had a lot of practice with how to raise kids and stuff. I was just pretty much following her lead through that process. All our kids are over 21 now, so we don't...
They're all registered adults now.
Yeah, right, and they pretty much earn their own paychecks and stuff, and so we don't really have any even financial parenting responsibilities anymore. So,
waiting for that day.
Yeah, right.
I'm working on it.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
I wanted to poke at your parenting, if I may, a little bit, because you have an unusual situation. You have one child by birth and one child by adoption.
Two by birth and one by adoption.
Oh, two by birth.
Yep.
Well, I think I've only met the two then.
Yeah, well, our oldest probably has not made very frequent visits at
to places that
we're
shared. Together.
Yeah. He was already up and out of the house. I mean, he's what, 27 now and been out of the house since he was just after he turned 18. He was gone.
Yeah, whereas your youngest went to high school with my kid.
That's right. And she just graduated in June. And so actually that was a sort of a big landmark for us. The third one done. So three
and
then
I came back home for very long.
No. No, I'm not sure if that's an endorsement or a slight on our parenting skills. But no, we definitely encourage them to be independent and adventurous and go find their own way in the world, and they've done just that. They're all adventurers themselves. So
they are. They all have interesting athletic interests and brain interests,
intellectual interests.
Yeah. And, that's better said than brain interests, I suppose. But yeah. What was the reasoning behind adoption?
That's a great question. No, I think that's a wonderful question, and I really love the reason, actually. As I mentioned, my wife has a lot of younger siblings. Most of the children in her family are males. As it turns out, most of the people in my family in my generation are males, my cousins and so forth and such. We had two boys. We had a miscarriage of a third child. It was also a boy. And we felt like we just wanted some girl energy in our world, and it didn't seem like the combining of our chromosomes was ever going to result in anything lacking a Y chromosome. So, so we decided to adopt because we wanted a girl, and so we did.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, and I fully support the adoption, especially with the organization that you worked with, because they're very well known, especially in our area.
Yeah, we love them.
For doing all kinds of wonderful things.
Right, not just adoption, but wonderful prenatal care, orphan care, and so forth all around the world.
Yeah, just generally kind of humanitarian organization, which is kind of awesome. Yeah. But yeah, I was always curious about the reasoning.
So simple as that.
So this is like this is the best genetic engineering ever. I just like found one that was guaranteed to be female.
Exactly, and the rest was irrelevant. You know, where she came from and so forth was completely irrelevant to us. It was just we just wanted a girl in the family, and it's worked out, you know, sort of as intended in that, you know. She brought the girl energy to the table that we were looking for. So, she, you know, my partner was feeling a little, you know, outnumbered, and our daughter evened the score.
Nice. Took on all three of you boys.
Yeah. Of course, became a tomboy herself. So.
Yeah, she's a spitfire. She's a great one, though. And it's clear. It's very clear that she comes from your house. If you met her and she were talking about her parents, unless she said something, you'd never pick up that she was talking about adoptive parents.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and we've encouraged, you know, her to do any seeking out of her pre-adoption history that she wants to, and so forth. We've been to her native country, and so forth.
You did that a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, good 10 years ago now. We did it when she was, I think, 11. We just wanted to make sure, you know, as she was coming of age, that she understood she had the opportunity to study her culture and go look for her birth family and all that kind of stuff.
Almost like a bat mitzvah. I mean, that's
kind
almost
of,
the right time.
Right, exactly. Yeah, now that you mention it. Yeah. Didn't
that's
think
amazing.
About it in that context, but yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was that kind of event. Yeah.
Huh.
She hasn't really expressed much interest in doing that, but she's certainly been encouraged to if she wants to. So.
And who knows? Maybe it'll come later in life.
Sure. Yeah.
I think a lot of people come to that discovery of we start trying to figure out who we are in our teens, I think. In our 20s, we start really questioning. And then in our 30s, we're starting to write dark poetry about it. it may come around. Who knows where she'll end up. back to adventure. Just before adventure, you said chemist.
Yeah.
Or scientist, I think, is the word you used, which I agree, because, like I said, you were testing rocks in the house just before we got on mic, and you have lots of other scientific avenues that you pursue. Where did that interest?
Oh.
Was it the same hike?
No, actually, I was not encouraged to pursue sciences. I was encouraged to pursue something much more practical in my life. But
like bricklaying or construction?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of world it was?
No, accounting or banking or something more practical like that.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the world I come from. I'm an East Coast escapee. But science was definitely a predilection I've had since an early age. I've always been interested in how the world operates in its most basic level. And of course, most of science is reductionism, so getting things to its most basic level. That's always been of interest to me. I want to know all the component parts of everything. So I guess that includes engineering as well, but...
You do engineering. Have you ever done engineering outside of the computer world?
You've
worked in roughly a computer engineering world for a lot of years. You moved on to some other things as well. But.
Yeah, no, I've mostly been a computer engineer is the term. I don't think that's really quite the right description. I've been a computer analyst for many years. I think it's probably more an apt term.
Than an engineer.
Yeah, right. I mean, I've spent my time, you know, developing things and stuff back in the day, and then I used to, for a long time, when everybody was figuring out how to connect the whole world, I spent 20 years building computer networks, you know, for companies and governments and
internal
stuff like that.
Internal networks.
Yeah, and then connectivity to the internet, and then connectivity to their peers and their vendors, and now... Now I break networks for a living. Now I break computer systems, which is certainly not engineering at all, but reverse engineering, I think, is the closest thing you could
exactly.
say to it, you could call it. Much easier building systems is way harder. You know, any edifice, right? I mean, this is the second law of thermodynamics, which states in a closed system, things fall apart. Right? And, yes. And of course, there are many exceptions to that, right?
Is that the law of decomposition?
Second law of thermodynamics. Yeah. Law of entropy.
And
there you
go.
Entropy. So the statement of the second law of thermodynamics is, in a closed system, entropy increases.
Disorder
increases. Now, of course, there are many exceptions to closed systems, right? The Earth's biosphere is an open system, right? There's a net input of energy. The sun is beaming down photons, and magma under the ground is welling heat and moisture up to us, and we live on this little biosphere that has a net input of energy. And as a result, the opposite of entropy can and will ensue if there's sufficient chemical diversity, will ensue, and complex structures will spontaneously evolve, because that's the corollary to the second law of thermodynamics. It's, you know, things fall apart in a closed system. In an open system, with a net input of energy, things become more complex. And that's why we're here having this conversation this evening. Right? What happened?
Technology came to a place where I can sit here in front of a recording device. Right.
Right. And we evolved as complex biological species because there is a net input of energy into our biosphere. But in the terms of computer engineering, what the second law of thermodynamics tells us is that it takes a huge amount of energy to build any edifice, and a trivial amount of energy to tear it all down. And so breaking computer systems is far easier than building them.
As anybody in Anonymous will tell you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's fascinating. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. By the scientific laws that are based.
Mm-hmm. It is a reflection of the second law of thermodynamics. And there's tremendous job satisfaction in that. Surveys have been done that show that in the in lots of industry surveys, demolition is the highest job satisfaction, blue-collar job there is on planet Earth. People love destroying stuff.
Well, yeah, and you always wanted to be the TNT guy because it's basically playing with giant firecrackers.
Who doesn't want to blow shit up?
Right.
And so blowing shit up, knocking it down with big balls, whatever, you know, jackhammering it, you name it. It's all fun and compared to other labor.
Till after 4 years, you have tinnitus and missing an arm. Right. And
But all those exceptions included, compared to other labor jobs, it is a high customer satisfaction. And we're essentially the demolition crew of the computer world. That's what we do, is computer demolition. So
That's kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, it's always been fascinating to me, but...
Yeah, and I can't talk about it much. I mean, the truth is, I'm just one step removed from the front lines of global cyber warfare, and... Yeah, so...
There's all your reasons for that. So, which brings me to my next thing. You were talking about entropy and the fierce input of energy on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And how that creates a change and up to a chemical change.
Complexity occurs.
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to get your take on the climate. And, I mean, it's very clear that humans have had an effect, but... What effect do you think that entropy, because like you said, heat is radiating up out of the Earth and beating down on the Earth.
Sure, yeah, I don't...
Just to get totally off topic.
I'm really not interested in talking politics, but I can tell you conclusively that in the last 150 years, the amount of carbon dioxide and other even more severe greenhouse gases has increased dramatically. Yeah. I mean, really dramatically.
If you look at NASA graphs, it goes straight up.
And that the combined volcanic eruption history of the Earth in the last 150 years has not contributed a full percent to that increase. It has all strictly been, carbon levels have been very stable for human terms for some while until the last 150 years.
5,000 years,
In human terms, right. In longer terms, not so much. But in human terms, it's been very stable. And carbon fixing by plant life has generally offset...
the global
volcanic emission of greenhouse gases. And, so gases get emitted, gases get absorbed, greenhouse gases get absorbed by plants by the very simple chemical reaction, H2O plus CO2 plus a photon equals CH2O and O2. And they fix carbon from the atmosphere into what eventually becomes cellulose on its way. You know, that's not cellulose to begin with, but it eventually becomes cellulose in the little factory there inside a plant. And that fixes the carbon that is, in a lot of cases, naturally emitted through methane leaks, volcanic activity, that sort of thing. So the answer is, yeah, it's anthropogenic global warming based on a dramatic increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the only possible explanation, I mean, if you just do the math, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere compared to 150 years ago versus the emission of greenhouse gases from internal combustion engines and other external combustion sources,
to the Industrial Revolution.
Subtract out volcanic activities, adjust for carbon fixing by plant life, and what you're left with is car exhausts and smokestacks that caused it all. There's absolutely no question. And all the stuff that people like to say, you know, all that inconvenient truth stuff about how it could be other things, it's just there's no scientific basis for that. And I'm sure you can find a scientist and you can pay him enough to say global warming is not fixed and set and absolutely unequivocal.
Any scientist but is just trying to make a living. It's humans almost are just tantamount humans to being an artist at this point right in time. You're just begging for a living when you're a scientist.
Well, the difference between science and every other endeavor is the truth will win out in the end, right? The difference between science and religion is if you wipe all the science off the face of the planet right now and you destroy all religious texts right now, today, 1,000 years from now, if society reemerges, science will have discovered the exact same things. Those religious texts will not be exactly the same. The difference is science has a self-correcting process built into it that all other human endeavors lack. All other human endeavors are characterized by coming to a conclusion and then seeking support for that conclusion. Science is the only human, and I include mathematics in science, science is the only human endeavor in which conclusions are only reached after assessing the facts, and if incorrect conclusions are reached, falsification is the primary activity of science, and falsification of those facts will occur, and the truth will win out.
I agree with you 100% with one caveat. Mm-hmm. I still think that religion, if you were to scratch everything, would come up with one tenet that is still common. And it is basically the golden rule.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
I think, and I'm a little bit larger fan of the platinum rule, if you know a little difference. Mm-hmm. But and anybody who listens to this has heard me talk about it before. But I think that one thing would still come out of any religion that was started right now.
Not any religion. I wouldn't say any religion.
Okay.
The ones that I would favor, for sure. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of Jesus philosophically. Mm. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. Do unto thy neighbor. Yeah. I mean, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. I mean, I could go on and on.
Being more Christ-like is a very good thing to achieve.
Absolutely.
Being like a Christ follower isn't always a great thing, because some of them are fantastic. Others are having some difficulty translating old teachings, I think.
I'm philosophically a huge fan. I just don't think that if all record of Christianity were wiped out, that in 1,000 years, that same text, the New Testament, since we're talking about Christ, same text, the New Testament, written as it was, it couldn't be. There's no letters from John. I mean, how could there be? I mean, you know.
Well, and the same thing is of the Talmud, and the same thing is
on and on
of all of them. There are a parable that is written frequently based on the life of a person. Mm-hmm. I believe that. But the story would be different. It would be based on a different person. Perfect example, not the best movie on the planet, but The Book of Eli, if you've ever seen it.
Sure, I liked it.
Is a perfect example. Yeah, it's not the perfectly made movie, but it was well done, and you can see why that would be the next story in the text, because everything was kind of wiped.
Yeah, in that case, they actually preserved the text.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah, right.
So before I move on to the next question, we have totally skipped over a name, so if you'd give me a name to put on the episode.
Alan.
Thank you. Now the next question is, and we've been getting into some of this already, always, is why? Why are you who you are?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So, you know, I have to give another scientific explanation for that one. I mean, as do we all, right? We're complex systems, as we were just talking about. Complexity spontaneously arises under the right conditions, and we're very complex, and who we become is the result of a very complex set of processes. I'm not sure I can pinpoint all of the initial indicators, but you know, in any complex system, to describe it mathematically, it's sensitively dependent on initial conditions. So this is a term characterized by a guy who wrote a meteorological paper back in 1961, a guy named Lorenz, who posited that a butterfly flapping its wings in Australia could cause a hurricane in Florida. And what he was describing was the effect of sensitive dependence on initial conditions. And the weather is a good example. It's very hard to project the weather beyond 4 or 5 days into the future, whatever the current state of meteorological accuracy is. And the frontiers of prediction will continue to push that threshold a little further into the future, but we will never be able to predict the weather with tremendous accuracy without actually understanding all of the initial conditions, which requires a model that is as complex as the system one is attempting to model. So this is the nature of complex systems. And so complex systems are sensitively dependent on initial conditions. So are you and I. I don't really know how it became this way. Like I said, I'm an East Coast escapee, grew up in New England, got introduced to the outdoors, grew up in the outdoors.
I loved your scientific explanation. It was fantastic. So go back to where you were. For those not as scientifically inclined, but that was a beautiful answer.
Yeah, I don't know how else to characterize it. I mean, anything else is telling stories, right?
I can tell stories. It's a cataclysm of events that makes us who we are.
And some little tiny things have...
Unpredictable ways.
Right. Little tiny events have disproportionate influence on future events. And big events sometimes have very little influence. It's hard to characterize. And there are so many of them. There are a myriad of them. For me, certainly big influences were growing up, you know, in a place that had winter, out in the country. I didn't really grow up in a suburban setting. So I was always kind of spent a lot of time outdoors.
Was it small town country, or was it country close enough that you went into big town?
Yeah, it was small towns. Okay. Small towns that just didn't really have anything more than, you know, 1,000 people and one little town center, and then some houses scattered around
with a swimming pool
with some farms and whatever. So that certainly fueled my interest in the outdoors. I mean, I was camping as a very little kid, you know, in the backyard or whatever.
It's always fun when you live in the woods and go camping in the woods.
Right. It's a little redundant, but, you know.
But still, it's away from home. Yeah.
Moved down the coast as a teenager. Made some great friends and really expanded my perception of the world. You know, I grew up in a completely white bread world. There was no prejudice in my world growing up, and I'm a child of the '60s and then early '70s when we moved down the coast. But there was no prejudice because there were no minorities.
It
was as white bread as white bread gets. And I moved to an area that had a large black population, and it was a real cultural...
By moving south
down the coast, my dad took a job down in Maryland, and down the coast we moved. And it was a wonderful experience culturally, really opened my eyes, and made some wonderful friends there, but didn't like it. It was flat. It didn't have any place to go mountain climbing. And again, I had already been introduced to hiking at that point in my life. And so my very first opportunity, I graduated from high school at 17, and I had two choices facing me. I was going to Colorado. I was going to Colorado to climb mountains, and I was either going to stick out my thumb and go to Colorado via hitchhiking and just, you know, find a job washing dishes or whatever so I could climb, or I was going to join the Army and get stationed in Colorado. So I ended up joining the service. I kind of wanted to join the service.
Air Force Base is in Colorado.
Yeah, I wanted to join the Army. I was definitely interested in soldiering.
But you wanted the
rocks.
I
was interested in being outdoors. I was interested in being in the infantry. So being in the Army was appealing to me. And it was that or stick up my thumb. And so when I went into the recruiter's office, the question was, what job do you want to do? And my answer was, I don't really care. I just want to be in Colorado where I can climb. And so I ended up picking a station rather than an MOS. And then as a secondary consideration, picked my job responsibilities. But no, I wanted to join the service and I wanted to climb. So off I went. I was stationed in Colorado for a couple of years and I got transferred overseas.
That was a time when everybody got transferred overseas.
Sure. Yeah, it was pretty routine. And that was all great. There's great climbing in Korea, so I had a wonderful time there. So have to be careful though. You really have to be careful.
There's stationed great climbing in Libya too, I hear, but I don't know if you've heard this story about these people.
Well, here's a story about climbing in Korea, is that I served on the DMZ. You know, I patrolled right there on the DMZ right after, Kim Jong-il took over, and things were very, very
tense
and uncertain. That, you know, they'd assassinated the South Korean president and blah, blah, blah. Things were very, very tense. But the thing is, climbing in Korea could only climb the south faces of the mountains, because there along the DMZ, we had mined and put missile emplacements on all the north faces, facing north. So you didn't want to be climbing on north face, because you would likely
blow yourself up
with a mine.
Yeah.
So you left the south faces open so we could retreat down the south faces.
Obviously a pretty clever military design, but B, works out really well for somebody in your situation.
Well,
there are safe faces to go up.
I just had to be aware of that before I started my climbing adventures.
That's cool. I bet it's very different visually climbing in Korea, just because the area is different than here. But what's it like? Are the rock walls the same?
Mm-hmm.
It's
kind of like
kind of grow as rocks.
Well,
to an uneducated person like me,
right? To a rock hound, they're wonderful rocks. They're continental rocks. They're great climbing. It's granite. It's great climbing. It's like going down to the Sierra Nevada in California and climbing. They're not as big as the Sierra Nevada, but wonderful rock. Yeah, really good climbing.
Huh?
Yeah.
And
yep.
You had enough free time to go do that.
That's, oh, sure.
That's even
better.
Well, and they paid to fly you over, and they put you up.
There you go.
Paid you
fed me three squares
and that.
Fed me three squares a day, and I was good. All you can eat in the mess hall. And I fell in love with Korean food. I pretty much went native when I was in Korea. Fell in love with Korean food and spent my own money on food a lot because it was so awesome. And it was super, super cheap.
Korean street food.
It's just
I mean,
awesome.
I watch travel TV show. Come on.
I mean, you got to like fish oil.
I definitely like fish oil, though. So we're in.
Yeah, everything smells kind of fishy in Korea, but as long as you're down with that, man, it is the greatest street food in the world, I think.
You've been a number of places, too.
Yeah, I've been a number of places in the East. I haven't spent a lot of time in Europe and Central Asia, but Eastern Asia, yeah, a couple different places. And I love street food everywhere, but Korean street food is
something
really strong, really fishy, really, really hot. Yeah.
Another thing I really like.
Yeah.
Give me some nice. Yeah.
It's like Thai food.
Into it, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what made me me. I mean, and then when I got done with my time in the service, I realized I didn't want to, do that forever. So I went to school.
You did one tour. Did the military help you pay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great.
When that was a functional system.
Yeah, it was a great system. Yeah, I didn't really pay for any college until my fourth year. First 3 years were pretty much paid for. Yeah.
We were talking earlier, you were scientifically based through college, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, I studied science. I also minored in English as an undergraduate, simply in an effort to meet... members of the opposite sex did not populate my chemistry labs. So
I took a lot of dance in college.
Yeah, I liked English. I was into
those
poetry.
Those numbers were really good. Never once worked out for me. But
yeah. I like poetry and literature, so it worked out okay for me. So I loved it. And yeah.
So more on the studious reading side than the creative writing side then?
Yeah, I just wanted to read stuff, interesting stuff. Literature and poetry was all I cared about. And it was easy to just get a minor in that.
Do you have any favorites?
Favorites? Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. For poets, my favorites. Well, one you would really like. My favorite 19th century poet is bar none, Edgar Allan Poe. As a steampunk, in addition to being a wonderful guy, a big steampunk hero and whatnot. I love him. I can recite Edgar Allan Poe poems. In the 20th century, I really like the heavy, super super heavy handed stuff T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound.
Okay.
I'm really, yeah.
Both,
I know it's kind of dense. It's dense and pretentious. But apart from that, so am I. I guess.
You're
I guess the answer is I'm dense and pretentious too. So yeah. So what the hell? I might as well like some Eliot.
I can self-identify.
Yeah, right.
That's what poetry can help you do.
Yeah, exactly.
I read a lot of Emily Dickinson in my late teens.
Yeah. Emily Dickinson. You know, I could almost go as my second favorite 19th century poet.
It's kind of alienation, but I love the alienation and the dark side and the questioning of the self and the position of the
planet.
She's
great.
It's like
I heard a fly buzz when I died.
Right.
Yeah.
I could not wait for death.
Death kindly stopped for me.
For me, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, it just sounds so trite when you say I love Emily Dickinson, because now I sound like you said, I kind of sound like a pretentious asshole. Yeah. But no, I like Emily Dickinson. It's okay.
Yeah. She was great. Yeah, I don't think she was pretentious. No,
I also like Broughton, who may not necessarily be a poet of sorts, but his writing. I mean, they call his books a Broughton for a reason, because they're different than anybody else. Like Trout Fishing in America, I read it 3 times. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so those are some of my favorites. Yeah, I just love reading. So
I'm kind of a fan. Well, it's the absorbing information part that I love too. Even if it's not nonfiction reading, just getting more stuff in.
Most of my reading is nonfiction, but I enjoy good fiction once in a while. A good author, I think. You know, George R. R. Martin said it best. You know, those who don't read live one life. Those who read live many.
It's a beautiful, beautiful quote.
Yeah.
Right up there with outside of a book, a dog is a man's best friend.
There you go.
Inside of a dog, or inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. Groucho Marx.
Well, you got a lot of friends. You're surrounded by a lot of friends.
Yeah, there's a lot of places to read.
Good doggies.
They are. They're something. They're noisy in the background, but. So what, back to official questions, what makes you unique?
I have no ability to judge what makes me unique, because I don't know what makes anybody else anybody else. I have no basis for comparison. I'm sorry, I only know myself. I certainly think that everybody is unique. Not only is it a unique genetic combination for every soul on the planet, but it's a unique set of those circumstances that make us the complex beings that we are for every soul on this planet. What makes me different from them is the same things that make them different from me. I'm not sure how else to answer that question.
Are you into chaos theory?
Oh, sure.
Okay, because a lot of what you've said so far
absolutely
has led to that.
Well, yeah, I would call it, beyond chaos theory is the theory of self-organized complexity, right? Mm-hmm. There are really three regimes in the universe. There is stasis, where nothing changes. There is chaos, where everything changes and nothing is measurable. And then there is that wonderful complex boundary between the two. In science, most commonly characterized by phase transitions, phase boundaries, the boundary between solid and liquid, the boundary between one molecule and another, the boundary between the shoreline and the solid earth. These are where all the action happens in the universe. All the complexity occurs.
The boundary between the liquid gases and the harder rock.
All of it.
Made the crystals that we're talking about.
Absolutely. Those boundaries, those phase transitions, are the realm of what's commonly referred to as SOC, or self-organized complexity. And so first there was Lorenz's paper that laid the groundwork for chaos. From chaos came the observation that there are some commonalities even in chaos, and that those are most strikingly evidenced in these conditions of phase transitions and phase boundaries in the universe. And this is true, again, from the boundary of a black hole to the boundary of a quark inside a proton. You know, these phase boundaries are where all the action in the universe happens. And
the majority of
the complexity occurs.
Because that's where the organization, as you said, self-organizing, but that's where all the organization, which is what is creation. It's just organizing a bunch of parts to create something.
The truth is, this mineral sample that we were identifying is in stasis right now. It's a metastable stasis. As conditions will change, it will change. But right now, at the atmospheric conditions sitting in the Earth atmosphere, this is stable. It's not going to change. And the truth is that the crystals contained herein can only carry and store so much information because they are static. On the other side, in chaos, we really can't track information, right? It's chaos.
Right.
We can't track it. But in between,
you can't build a status or a baseline in a sense of chaos.
Right. In between, in the realm of complexity, there is a huge amount of information. The vast majority of the information of the universe is contained in complex systems, in your DNA. Which is not immutable like this, which combines with someone else's DNA to create your offspring.
Which is
a complex process.
Yeah.
It's a complex system, and there's an incredible amount of information stored in that system.
So, to some extent, more simplistically, just to paraphrase, your DNA makes you unique.
Absolutely. And everybody else, right? It's the DNA is why no two people may have common characteristics, right? Because we're complex systems. But no two people really can be the same.
I firmly believe that even in the case of extremely similar DNA, identical twins, for instance, those two people, because of the complexity of the system that they grow up in, because even though they may wear the same haircut and have matching outfits, because there's lots of those twins out there.
Right.
Not that all of them are. But being as similar as they can, they are going to have experiences that are individual. And not just individual because they're separate, but individual in that they may be in the same place, but they're doing it through their own eyes, their own experience judgments, their own value systems, and it makes them...
And they will interpret things differently, even the exact same events.
Yes.
Yep.
I think we could straight up clone a person and it would be a different person.
Absolutely. Yep. I agree completely. It's a combination, again, of genetics and environment, both complex systems, both rife with information that we all have to sift through.
For dramatic and sudden change.
Yep.
One of those twins gets hit by a bus, they're still identical twins. One of them is now paraplegic.
Yep. In modern physics vernacular, I'm sorry, I bring everything back to science. But this is an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking, right? Mm-hmm. You can take identical twins out of the womb who we could consider for all intents and purposes to be symmetric. And the scientific definition of symmetric is, identical when viewed from different directions, so to speak, right? Or you can rotate it and it still looks the same. Right? But they come out, let's say even for the sake of argument, that they are symmetric when they come out. symmetry breaks. Symmetry is a metastable condition. It's going to fail.
It's going to fall apart.
Yeah, and so they will ultimately take different trajectories. It's impossible for it not to happen. I mean, it's not impossible. The second law of thermodynamics tells us it's not impossible. It's just vanishingly improbable.
Well, most things in the universe as a whole are merely improbable.
That's right.
Humans being one of the best examples I've ever run across.
Right. Unless, of course, you know, all my statements don't hold true if the universe is infinite. In that case, then, there are identical human beings, and in fact, there are an infinite number of them. But I'm not sure that the universe
is infinite. Then you're running down the delineating path where every break of empath that was ever even fathomed is happening somewhere. The parallel universe theory.
And it does make everything exist. Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics posits that both events happen. Schrodinger's cat is both alive and dead.
All at once.
Yeah. Well, into bifurcating universes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And if one takes the number of events that would be bifurcating every, you know, Planck time, you know. It would be, there's a lot of universes out there. Infinity is a really hard concept.
The
yeah, right. All of them over and over and over again an infinite number of times.
So I know we're in a little time thing, so I'm going to push forward.
Fun conversation.
I'm a
sorry.
Huge fan.
You're encouraging me. I don't usually get to, you know, reduce everything to its first principles in a conversation.
Every conversation is different. The dog interrupts. So, yeah, a little break because of noise. The next question is, would you tell me about a defining moment?
Sure. Probably the most important defining moment for me was meeting my wife. Well, my future wife-to-be. We met taking a rock climbing class. And I had just moved to Oregon. And there was no ice rink in town. I'm a lifelong hockey player, ice hockey player. Grew up in hockey country.
Northern back east.
Yeah. And there was no ice rink, so I was determined to leave as soon as my studies. I was doing some graduate work at the university. Leave as soon as my studies were complete. Meeting my partner changed my opinion on the importance of my career in science. She was not interested in following me around from one postdoc to another. I was not interested in leaving her. I, by then, developed a really strong affinity for the Western Oregon area. And so I gave up geochemistry and went a different direction. So I would say that's a really important defining moment for me. Yeah.
So you said you were doing doctorate work. So you got to be like, what, 24, 25 when you met?
Yeah. Yeah, we Somewhere got married, there? I guess, when I was 25 or 26. Yeah.
For the record, I love your wife, and if she's willing to do this...
I doubt it.
There's frequently that in a couple. Like, one person's willing to do this, the other person just rather have the conversation on a bench somewhere.
Yeah, right. So I would say that was a really defining moment, because up until that point, I was motivated by my studies, and I didn't, you know, I was just living wherever, the life of a academic vagabond, and that was okay with me up until that point.
Did you finish that doctorate?
No. I dropped out of grad school and went to work in the computer business because in those days, this is the mid-80s now, in those days, there weren't computer applications to do everything. Now there's an app for that. In those days, I had to write my own apps for that. So I had to write apps to collect my data from the electron microprobe and the scanning electron microscopes and stuff. I had to collect the data. I had to normalize the data. I had to model the data. I had to, you know, report on the data. And pretty much all of those processes had to be written. So what do you know? I guess that made me a computer expert. So I dropped out and went into the computer business.
Well, so, and at that point in time, there really wasn't much for computer experts.
Yeah, I mean, there was a fledgling computer science program at the University of Oregon, I think, and a fledgling computer engineering program at OSU. But yeah, no, it was it was knowledge that was not very common at the time. It was just all self-taught. I mean, I just opened up a couple of books on Fortran and yeah.
It's funny. I just learned what Fortran meant. Like I knew it was a language.
Fortran 77, baby.
Exactly. I just recently we were doing the other podcast. We were doing an episode on IBM, and I learned a lot. Yeah. You know, especially having been a Mac guy my entire life. There's two of them sitting right next to us.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm dating myself.
It's okay. We all do it.
By noting my coding history. So yeah. So I dropped out of academics and just went into computers.
Computers and adventure.
Yeah.
And became Indiana fucking Jones.
I guess. Just me living my life.
Short of golden idols. Like, you definitely bring treasures home. They just look a lot like rocks.
Yeah. Yeah, we do a lot of rock hunting. You know, when the kids were little especially, we would drag them through the dirt to go climbing. And they weren't always that interested in climbing. They were kids. So rock hunting was a wonderful outlet. So when we'd plan a climbing trip, we'd plan a little, you know, mineral hunting adventure to go along with it. And, you know, what can I say? I'm driven by the desire to turn over that rock and see what's under it, to go around that bend and see what's beyond it, to go over the hill and take a view from the top. That's all I really care about doing. The rest is just making a living.
Yeah. To drop your post-grad work and go marry a wonderful person.
Who likes to adventure. Yeah. So there you go.
Were you driven for a family and parenting before you met her? Or was that one of the changes that happened?
No, I wasn't really thinking about that at all in my life when we met. That again, she was sort of all set to become a mother. I had to make a lot of mistakes along the way until I finally figured out just to emulate her and it would all be okay. So. She had a lot of practice. I didn't have any.
So. You brought this up before, but there is a lot of truth to that. Like many men who have been in long-term relationships can say to some extent, like, I had to learn to cool my jets, be less an idiot and do a better job.
Yeah. And again, she had 8 younger siblings. So she was sort of like, she was like sort of like second mom in her household. And so she did everything from changing diapers to helping younger ones with homework to whatever, solving whatever problems they had. And it was all, you know.
Yeah. Even at highest pace, you're 12 years older than the youngest when you have 8.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So, yeah. Huh. So I just, you know, quickly relinquished any, self direction and just followed her lead. And it all worked out okay because she knew what she was doing. So,
and told you when you didn't.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's exactly what we need. Yep. Yeah, most of us.
Yeah. So,
all right. It is the last question. What makes you similar to other people?
The desire to be better than myself. Desire to be better than who I am today, tomorrow.
I admittedly have lost a lot of faith in humankind, and I'm not sure that that is a common trait. Do you really think it is a common trait?
Oh my gosh, yeah, I do. You know, I don't think that people's circumstances are necessarily, you know, a character flaw, right? And I'm not speaking for people who have antisocial tendencies or whatever. I mean, there are obviously people who fail to interact in a social setting. And let's first of all just cut that subpopulation out. But speaking for the general population, I mean, I've seen people in the depths of the darkest depths of fighting addiction and losing and still I've seen people, you know, in terrible poverty and fighting to scratch out a better existence. I do think it's a universal trait, and I don't think it's a character flaw if you find yourself in one of those situations. And I think everybody wants to, most everybody who interacts socially wants to be a better person tomorrow than they are today. Yeah, I have faith in humankind, actually.
Part of that was a baited question.
decision-making isn't always the best. I'm not sure that I, have a lot of faith in people's decision-making, but that doesn't... that's how I think I'm listening.
And that's some of the baiting of the question, is that what I've learned, one thing that I've learned from doing these, and from further exploration before I started this particular passion project, was that I do... as much as I have lost a lot of faith in humankind... And it's humankind as a whole, not humankind as an individual. I think that when you approach an individual as an individual, most people genuinely have a desire to make the world better for themselves and those around them. And so, yes, to paraphrase like you said, to be better than they were yesterday. And I do think that the individual level we do. But once we get to the mass level, that... the give a shit goes away. It becomes so much. It's like having a heady conversation. People frequently will shut down. That's why things like politics and the environment and things are very difficult conversations to have, is because it's so much that people don't can't even come up with answers on their own or put words to them. What do you think? Since I baited the question,
I think mob mentality takes over. Right, one dog is a pet, three dogs are a pack. I mean, it's the same with...
Does the guy with three dogs in the pack right now?
I thought it's an apt metaphor. It's true if you're raising children. It's true if you're running a political campaign.
It's true if you're into plural marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with extra complexity in that case, I'm sure. A polyamorous life is among the more complex ones, I imagine.
Not the easy path.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, mob mentality takes over, and it's easy to play to pay people's baser instincts, and the subtle difference between truth and lies has been so hard to validate in a digital world. And I actually spend a lot of my time thinking about the difference between fact and fiction in a digital world, and follow all the publications on those topics and stuff.
You appear to me to be a person that reads a little bit from both sides of the column, just to make sure you have a basis you can build yourself.
I wouldn't consider myself very well informed politically in terms of the sides of the columns. But I like to be informed as to the concepts that we're dealing with. So, And that usually then drives my affiliations. So, yeah.
I really don't have anything else to say other than just continuing the conversation for a little bit too long.
Yeah, well,
like I said, I know you're on a schedule to be on time to your own home.
Who doesn't enjoy talking about themselves, right?
Oddly enough, a lot of people. I really, as a person, I've always found you fascinating, so I really appreciate you sitting down and finding the time. I know it's taken us a little time to put it together.
You haven't interviewed a lot of geeks, so...
Well, it depends on your level of geekery. I've interviewed some pretty heavy gamers.
Yeah.
Some people that are very committed to the comedy scene.
Really interesting people, don't get me wrong. I just mean techno geeks.
Yeah. Well, there's a thing with techno geeks. They don't tend to leave their house very often. Yeah.
Right. There you go. There you go. You had to drag me in kicking and screaming, but... Yeah. But I came out and did it, so, yeah.
I really appreciate it.
It was quite fun. I would like to continue the conversation into the political realm, but not.
I will gladly do it off mic. I don't do that on mic very often
because I similarly find you as someone who's not easily swayed by any particular party line. I think there are. If you want to talk more about,
well, I will say this on mic because I've said it before. Yeah. When I turned 18, I registered as a libertarian because I read all of their statements and that made the most sense to me. And I'm really just pleased with the libertarians right now, but. I do like the premise.
I voted for the independent in my first presidential election vote. Yeah. So I was similarly inclined, I guess. Yeah.
I'd like to invite you back for the second set of questions as I start coming around.
Okay.
But thank you very much. Good fun. I'm going to press stop. We can talk some more.